Pat Benatar announcing the launching of her own little surveillance program, I'm going to follow you. That could be the theme song for NCIS in San Diego, at least as it applies to Damien, the key figure in this book, Camellia, by Robert Guffey. Robert and Damien were followed, I guess, all the way across the country. This went on for months and months at a time, and I guess at some point you could say it sounds preposterous that anyone would put that much effort into it, or that there is such a thing as an invisibility cloak being used by spies to mess with people's minds. And that might be true until you reach the point where Robert and Damien meet and talk to the scientist who not only invented it, but patented this technology, and says that it was in the hands of the Army and Navy and other intel-type folks years ago. We're going to get to that in this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Guffey, I wanted to make the point that while your friend Damien, or Dion, as you call him in the book, is a heroin user, a methadone, and a variety of other drugs, I would imagine, over the years, you're not. You don't even drink, right?
Right. I've never even had coffee.
And you saw some of this stuff for yourself. I think we skipped over this part, but, you know, in between the time when this started happening and when Damien goes on the road, or while he's on the road, you experienced some really weird stuff with phone calls, trying to send him some money.
Oh, yes. When I was trying to send him the money to send him the $500 to get the van, to buy the van from the beachcomber, remember, Damien did not ask me to do this. I chose to do it, and so it was going to be a complete surprise, and I wanted it to be a surprise because I didn't want anyone to know that it was going to happen so that they couldn't prevent it from happening.
You figured they're listening to your phone, right?
That was clear. Yeah, that had been made clear earlier. And so I called him, and I wanted to give him the password. When you send someone money via Western Union, you have to give them a password so they can pick it up. So I wanted to give it to him. I told him, there's $500 waiting for you, so you can get the van and leave today. Here's the password. And then he stopped me and he said, wait, I'll call you back and get it from you, which was a mistake because every time he tried to call me back, the phone would go out right when I would try to give him the password. I would start to give it to him and then it would go out. He'd call back. I'd get out one syllable, boom, and then it would cut out again over and over and over again. And then I realized it was something unique to if you place a collect call, there's a second there where the operator is asking the other person, will you accept the collect call? In that moment, you can actually hear the other person.
Right.
So as the operator was asking, Damien, will you accept the collect call, I yelled out the password really quickly, and then I heard him laugh, and then it cut out at that moment. So he got the in fact I didn't yell out the password. It was a clue that I can't even say on the air.
Right. Right.
That I knew he would know, and so he was able to get it, and that way someone else couldn't get there in front of him and use the password and pull out the money before he got there. So that was successful.
But, I mean, there's no question somebody was messing with the phone line, so you could not communicate with him, and so he couldn't get out of town.
It seems like a bizarre coincidence if it was just a coincidence. Yeah, it seemed improbable that it would just be a coincidence that happened at that moment over and over and over again.
I should point out you had some other support for the story along the way, is that you ran into a woman who had a very similar experience, not only just in the general area, but specifically in the same area, same neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. She told me that she was followed into the very same 7-Eleven there on Garnet Avenue. In the same location, the same time period. Yeah, that was very strange. And I should mention an incident that occurred while Damien was en route to Winona, Kansas, because it's actually kind of important. I mentioned earlier that there were only two times where these people actually broke the script and actually admitted that they were watching him. The first time was when Lita Johnson said, yes, that was funny with the food fight, amused us. That was the first time. The second time was kind of creepier because Damien stopped off in Minnesota, and he was in a bathroom in the middle of nowhere, and he's washing his hands at the sink, and a guy comes in and goes right up to him, and he looks at him in the mirror. He's at the sink right next to him, and he says, if you just give everything back, this will all end. And this is, you know, this is a random encounter in the bathroom. And Damien looks at him, and the guy looks like he looks like he's more tired than Damien is. And it sounds as if what he's saying is, could you please just give this stuff back so we can stop this? Because this is, I think by this time they realized that Damien was kind of inexhaustible, like that he was not going to give in, he was not going to go insane, and I think maybe it even fascinated them. How much can this guy take, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, maybe because of his years of drug abuse, he basically became indestructible or insensitive to pain, or he could just withstand all incredible amounts of whatever.
He could withstand incredible amounts of pain. I was with him, and we would see him drink so much alcohol that it would kill a stronger man. So I think that was part of it. And so anyway, while this guy is talking to him, another guy comes into the bathroom, grabs this other guy by the collar, and like drags him out, as if this other guy had broken protocol by talking to Damien. This spooked Damien. He ran out of the bathroom, got back in his van, and then drove. Eventually, ended up in Winona, Kansas, where he stayed for several months. And it was there in Winona that where he had some breathing room that he started going on the internet trying to find something that looked like the invisibility technology that he had seen in the apartment. And he found a guy named Tashi, who was a Japanese professor who had created this invisibility cloak, not unlike the story that broke a couple of days ago. And that didn't look like it. It didn't look anything like what he had seen. Then he stumbled across this website, Chameleo, projectchameleo.net, run by this fellow named Richard Schoengert. And he sent me a link to the site and said, you should look at this because this sounds really close to what I was experiencing. So I'm looking at it as, and by the way, synchronicity plays a huge role like through this whole epic storyline. As I'm looking at this website, I see there's this fellow. His name is Richard Schoengert. He's a scientist. He has top secret clearance. He works at Northrop Grumman, the El Segundo division. Project Chameleo is this private operation that he has going, not connected to Northrop Grumman. And I see that he is a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason. And I am a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, and that he belongs to the lodge in Long Beach. And I also belong to the lodge in Long Beach. So I suddenly realized that we're in the same Masonic lodge in Long Beach, and that I must have met him at some point in the past, or I must have interacted with him and didn't know it. So I sent the guy an email. And I said, Mr. Schoengert, I'm a member of the Scottish Rite in Long Beach, and I do interviews, and I mentioned other interviews I had done, and I said I'd like to interview you about this technology, this invisibility, chameleonic technology that you talk about here on your website. And he wrote back and he said, oh, sure, you know, I'd love to meet you. So we arranged to meet, and Damien drove all the way to Long Beach in his van, and we arranged to have lunch. And I told Richard Schoengert that I was going to bring a friend of mine along. So I went to the lodge that morning. It was a Saturday morning. I went there. I met him. I realized I had met him before. I had seen him perform rituals at the Scottish Rite many times in the past. I instantly recognized him. And he leads me to his car in the parking lot, and we go have lunch, and I bring Damien along. We all three of us have lunch, and then we take him back to the Long Beach campus where I teach, and we both interviewed him for about 2.5 hours. And I entered into this not really knowing if this was going to lead anywhere. It could be that everything he was going to say would have no connection whatsoever to what Damien had experienced. Instead, as he's talking, about 20 minutes into it, everything he's saying is linking up in bizarre ways to everything that has occurred. He mentions that he had had encounters with the Navy, that the Navy had come out and spoken to him and were very interested in his technology. 12 years earlier, you know, this encounter with the Navy had occurred 12 years before we're interviewing him in 2007 or 2006. And he even mentions at one point, sort of offhandedly, wonders aloud, before we've even told him any of this, he wonders aloud, he says, I've often wondered if they stole the technology from me, because he proceeds to tell us a story about a military symposium that he attended a year prior in 2005, where he was giving a presentation on this technology, and a woman stands up in the audience and says, "You can't be talking about that. That's top secret information." And from the podium, Richard says, "No, it's not top secret information. This is my own technology that I invented." And she says, no, the Invisibility Soldier Project is completely top secret, and you're not allowed to be talking in this venue about it. And Richard said, "Well, after this presentation, we'll go out in the parking lot, and I'll prove to you that this, is, in fact, is not top secret information." And so after he finished the presentation, she took him into a room. He got grilled for about 20 minutes. Finally, he showed them the paperwork to prove that, in fact, this was a project he was working on privately and that he was not working on it for any sort of secret government agency. And once he had convinced them of that, they grudgingly kind of let him go. So that was one of the first indications to him that this was already operational.
You also found, I'm sorry to divert you away, but you also found something called Defense Review, an article from March of 2005. I remember being struck by this in the book, that it was pretty significant, because the article from 2005, and this is a really respected Pentagon-related publication, which says, "Hopefully the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps will soon have operational and effective electro-optical camouflage, a.k.a. adaptive camouflage, chameleonic camouflage, cloaking technology for infantry, soldiers, Marines, and combat systems." I mean, that's pretty blatant.
Oh, yeah. His proposals, he was taken very seriously, and certainly his partner, Dr. Lev Berger, is an eminent physicist, and he was taken seriously as well. They did many presentations at military symposiums about the uses of this. While I'm talking to him, I started asking him questions like, could this technology be used to do things other than make people invisible? Could you use it to make an object look like something else? And he says, "Absolutely, you could. That's in my patent." I told them, you know, when they met with me, that that's one of the things you could do. You could make a tree look like something else. And he said, "You can make someone go crazy, potentially." And so as he's talking about this, he mentions that SAIC from San Diego had come to talk to him about 10 years earlier as well. After he says all of this and then other things, the whole transcript of our conversation is in the book. At a certain point, I say, "Well, Damien has a story to tell you," and Damien proceeds to tell him the whole story, everything I've just told you. And at first, he looked a little incredulous or maybe a little skeptical. But I remember the point where all that changed was when Damien mentioned seeing the people in the mirror when he moved the mirror. And then also seeing the auras, that he said sometimes he could see them as these little dots in the air. And Richard leaned forward and he said, "That's exactly what it looks like when it's not working right." And that, at that point, I could tell that Richard was fully invested in hearing the rest of the story.
Can you give us in layman's terms what he told you about how it works? I mean, how does it work? How do you become invisible?
Well, it's much different from, for example, Tashi's invisibility cloak. Professor Tashi's invisibility cloak requires that you basically remain stationary for it to work. Obviously, that's not going to work in a battlefield situation. So essentially, it's a series of cells or lenses that reflects the background. Whatever the background is, it reflects it and projects it onto the person as they're in motion. Tashi's visibility cloak, or the one that was recently made the news a couple of days ago, wouldn't work the same way as Richard's technology would work. Also, because you're And by the way, that's why it was visible in the mirror, because they were cloaking the person, but they weren't cloaking the mirror, and that's why they could see it. And I think that's one of the reasons why they were using Damien as a kind of canary in the coal mine, as a kind of guinea pig, to see when the technology would break down. After all, you'd want to use it in a kind of unpredictable live situation before you sent people into Afghanistan, or some place where they could actually get shot or killed. Why not test it in a real live situation first? And I think that's exactly what they were doing, and that's what Richard thought they were doing. We spoke to Richard for, as I said, about 2.5 hours. And everything he said lined up with Damien's experiences. And then after that, Damien moved to an area called the Lost Coast, up in the Pacific Northwest. And he moved in. His mother had a house sort of in the middle of nowhere in Humboldt County. And Damien moved into there. And the second he moved in, all these drones start flying over, classic, George Adamski-type UFOs are flying over, so much so that the locals thought that it was the DEA coming in trying to raid their marijuana gardens, and they'd come out with their rifles and shoot at these drones as they were flying over. And none of this activity was going on before Damien moved in. And, go on.
I want to return back to, you can continue that part of it, but I want to return back to this interview with the engineer, because there's a lot of stuff we missed. But you can continue the story about the UFO stuff in the marijuana area.
Well, basically that situation escalated to the point where some of the harassment was starting again. There was a period of time there where it had kind of died down, particularly when there was a period there where Damien was living in San Francisco, and he noticed that it would only start up if, for example, there was a Occupy Wall Street protest going on in San Francisco, or some mass kind of protest going on, which, of course, being San Francisco, happens often. And he learned to stay indoors on those days, because if he'd go outside on those days, the harassment would start again, almost as if someone's, pulling a lever and saying, okay, these are the people in the area that you need to be following on a day like this, during a situation like this. So the harassment sort of began again, and then he eventually left his mother's house and moved elsewhere, and now he's just the harassment has sort of abated a bit, and he's just laying low.
Well, there's a lot more to cover.
Yes.
I was curious about whether you ever felt that you were targeted. I know you had the conversation with the NCIS agent. You were there when the phones were messed up. You heard a variety of different kind of phenomena. You know that it's real, but did they ever come after you?
I wouldn't say that I've ever been gang stalked. However, I do feel like I've been approached on several occasions by mysterious people in unusual circumstances trying to pump information out of me. For example, there was one occasion where I was supposed to meet a friend of mine, and we were going to go out for lunch, and she was taking the bus to my apartment building where I was living at that time in Long Beach. While she's on the bus, this complete stranger introduces himself to her and offers to buy her and me lunch.
At a very expensive restaurant. I'll tell you what, I'm sorry, the music tells us we got to take a break here. We'll pick up that story with my guest Robert Guffey after this on Coast to Coast AM. A lament about loss and alienation, Green Day, Wake Me Up When September Ends, from the politically charged mega hit album American Idiot some years ago. We're talking with Robert Guffey about his book Camellio. And still ahead, sort of the larger ramifications of this. If you have invisibility technology, the kinds of things that you can do with it to mess with people. For example, a lot of reports about abductions that are ascribed to aliens, alien abductions, but that involve military personnel, according to some of the witnesses. Is that where this leads? One of the other paths that we'll look at is Area 51, whether there's a Lazar connection to this. and Phil Corso and perhaps Skinwalker Ranch, a lot of territory that I know a little bit about, and maybe you do as well. Some strange stuff still to come in our conversation with Robert Guffey here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Let's resume the story you were telling, Robert, before the break. You talked to this girl on the phone. You set up a date. She's going to come over, take the bus, and come over and meet with you. You're going to go on a date. And then while she's on the bus, this stranger introduces himself to her, and suddenly it's three people on the date. Go ahead and continue.
He said he was a dock worker at Long Beach, and he introduced himself to me. I shook his hand. His hands are like baby's hands, but supposedly he's a dock worker. He's got manicured fingernails. And he takes us to an expensive restaurant in Long Beach, and he starts saying the strangest things to me. And by the way, I should mention that Damien had been staying at my apartment only a couple of days before, and in fact, rather cryptically, he said to me, you know, you should be careful of strangers who suddenly introduce themselves into your life. And he gave this to me as a kind of warning before he left. And I thought that was kind of odd and cryptic. And then suddenly, here's the situation. And we're standing there waiting to go into this restaurant. He turns to me and he says, are you into conspiracies and conspiracy theories? I am. And I said, oh, no, not really. And he seemed completely confused by that response, as if I was supposed to say something else. And then he goes, I just read a book called Behold a Pale Horse by Milton William Cooper. Have you ever read that book? And I go, no, I've never read that book. and he keeps referring to him as Milton Cooper, even though anyone who has read Behold a Pale Horse and knows anything about conspiracies or UFOs always refers to him as Bill Cooper or William Cooper. He keeps calling him Milton Cooper because that's what it says on the spine of the book, Milton William Cooper. So this guy who's supposedly like really into conspiracies keeps calling Bill Cooper Milton Cooper. And he says, you should read this book. It's really fascinating. He goes, do you think that maybe... What do you think of George Bush? You think he's a good president? And I said, oh, yeah, I love George Bush. He's a fantastic president. And then he said, yeah, you know, I think we should have a revolution in this country. What do you think?
It was like he was trying to bait you into something, right?
Oh, yeah, it was ridiculous. And nothing I said seemed to jive with what he was told I was supposed to say, you know, so he was just kind of, the whole thing became a comedy of errors. And then there's been several other strange incidents. For example, there was one weekend, I had been out of touch with Damien for a couple of years there, and then we got back in touch with each other right about 2010, something like that. And my wife and daughter were supposed to go away. We were all supposed to go away on the weekend to Santa Barbara. The last minute, I decided to stay behind to write. So I was in my office writing that whole day, and at around 2 in the morning, stopped and went into my bedroom, turned on the light. When I turned on the light kind of flooded the alley outside. The moment that happened, I heard all this scrambling going on in the alley below, and these people kind of running off down the alley. I should mention that earlier, the day before, I had sent an email to Damien telling him I had just found in my storage space a lot of his old manuscripts, his writings. So I sent him this email, and I said, I found a lot of I found a lot of your stuff, but that's not the word I use. I found a lot of your stuff in my storage space. Do you want me to send it to you, or should I hold on to it? It's not going anywhere. Okay, now flash forward. There's these people scrambling down the alleyway. I didn't think anything of it, really. I was tired, and I just went to sleep. Next morning, I wake up. I go outside. The guy, the neighbor who lives downstairs, says, did you see the garage? Now, I should point out that I had a storage space that was off-site in another city. That was the storage space I was referring to. But there were also storage spaces below in the garage. And it could be that they misread that email, because we went down in the garage and the whole place was just completely torn apart, but nothing was taken. There was all this expensive electronic equipment that the neighbor had stored down there. That wasn't taken. I had two bikes down there that could easily have been just rolled on out of there. Those were not taken. There was a motorcycle that was not taken. And the place was just completely ripped apart. So I don't know if the Barney Fife types who were like reading the email got into their head that the stuff I was referring to were these goggles.
Wow.
They thought that I had them. It could be a total coincidence that happened in that time frame. But there's several things like that.
We'll come back to the goggles, too, sometime before the program ends, because there's some speculation about what they might really be able to do, why there was this insistence that they get them back. I mean, obviously, they have value, but maybe this is beyond what we might assume. There were, you know, these stories that are told by victims of gang stalking, these are sad stories. I mean, I'm sure that some of these people have mental issues. But it could be that some of them really aren't being targeted and are messed with. And it goes beyond just mental confusion. You said that in the book you outlined some of the things that happened to Damien. I mean, it was really painful. It seemed like he had constant headaches, that there were noises in his head, and it seemed to be some sort of a targeted kind of technology that your interview with this inventor, this engineer, I mean, he lent some support to the idea that this stuff is real, and you found other evidence for it, too.
Oh, yeah. We even asked Richard, could you make it seem as if a room was getting smaller or larger, that a room was larger on the inside than it appeared on the outside? He said, absolutely, you could do that. And that's exactly what was happening in Pacific Beach. And they are sad stories, and I've heard a lot of them now since the book was published, and also there was a shorter version of the story that was the cover feature of 40 and Times a couple of years ago in issue, I think, 305. So I heard from people after that article as well, and also since the book has been published. I should point out that it's not just drug addicts and people like that who are targeted. It seems to me that if you piss off one of these people and they have access to this technology, or they have access to this whole gang stalking community, your life's going to be a living hell after that. For example, Gloria Naylor, who's a well-respected literary author, she's famous for having written Women of Brewster Place and Mama Day and other novels like that. Everything that happened to Damien happened to her. And she wrote a book about it called 1996, which is presented as a novel, but she says that it's not a novel. This happened to her, and the reason it's called 1996 is because that's when her harassment started. She was living on an island off the coast of, I believe, Maine, if I remember correctly. She was living in a house next door to a guy whose brother was in the NSA. Gloria Naylor accidentally poisoned the neighbor's cat. And at that point, all this harassment stuff that happened to Damien happened to her. And she wrote this book, 1996, which her regular publishers did not publish. A smaller press published it because they thought she'd gone nuts. and so it's not just drug addicts, you know, it's not just people on the fringes. Gloria Naylor's a well-respected writer. And even she found it difficult to get her story out.
The idea that you can give somebody a headache, or that you can, you know, there are weapons that transmit noise into somebody's head, you found evidence that that's real. I mean, there's really research going on into that.
Oh, yeah. I mean that's been known for a while. In fact, Walter, I mentioned that I was friends with Walter Boart. He talks about it in Operation Mind Control, the ability to bypass the ear canal and implant sounds directly into your head, so it sounds like there are voices speaking to you inside your head. I should also point out that something kind of, one of the things that motivated me to get Damien out of San Diego was an incident where he experienced in a kind of twilight sleep, an experience where he was on his couch in his living room in the apartment. And these people came in and held him down and injected something into his arm. And he and I know this was not some sort of nightmare because it's the only time I've ever heard Damien referred to a needle with fear. And it was something he tried to struggle away from them, but they were injecting him with this thing, and it was something he distantly had this memory, as I say, as if it occurred in a twilight sleep. And that seemed really disturbing to me, and that was one of my main motivations for sending him the money to get him out of there. But in terms of the what you could do with this technology, the invisibility technology, I mentioned earlier that I was reading your book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, and there's an incident that occurs in there where you call him Tom Gorman, the man in the ranch, and his
right.
son, see this sort of pixelated predator figure, right? And later on, it comes out of the trees there, and later on, they're watching Predator, and they said that's exactly what we saw. And of course, Predator is a science fiction movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, in which there's an alien that has this kind of camouflage technology. And that movie, Richard Schoengert, in fact, references that movie in our interview with him and says, yeah, that's sort of what it is. That's what it looks like. And, in fact, the Predator movie came out around the time that he started developing the technology. And so when I read that in your book, and also there's a part where you're mentioning that there was a team, five teams of remote viewers who
yes.
were asked to remote view the ranch, and they mentioned that they had seen that they all thought there was some sort of military connection to the ranch, and that one of them mentions that the overall impression of the group was that the location was the site of a military operation, an operation that most likely involved the U.S. Navy, and that was point one that dinged in my head. And then one of you described the Pentagon. Two perceived images of a Navy ship, perhaps an aircraft carrier, which was somehow linked to the activity in Utah. The viewers saw armed men in military uniforms who wore dark sunglasses and sported Navy tattoos. And when I got to the dark sunglasses part, that also sparked, it made me think of the goggles.
Oh, yeah.
And also the orbs that were sort of surveilling them on the ranch, which I have a photograph in the front of Camellio of one of these orbs of light that was following Damien around. He got some photographs of them, but of course, often it just looks like a bright blob against a black background.
Right.
I picked the best one and put it in the front of the book. Also, the way that the orbs would there's one moment where you describe Gorman as suddenly making the decision to do something he wouldn't normally do, and he like runs for the thing, and he is actually able to trick the thing and hide in a haystack while it's searching for him, and that reminded me of sometimes people contact me. They say, how should we deal with this? Well, of course, I have very little advice in that regard, but I do think that if you read Camellio and see the way that Damien dealt with this situation, you can apply it to your own situation. And I think the thing that to keep in mind is to do the unexpected. We all become addicted to patterns. Wake up at the same time every day, you go to the same spot every day for lunch, and et cetera, and they know that, and they're able to, by disrupting those patterns, they disrupt you. And so if you can disrupt that pattern and do things that are unexpected, which Damien often did, for example, with the food fight with the feds, it seemed like he was able to keep a step ahead of them. John Rappaport, who's an investigative reporter, he is a brilliant writer. He wrote AIDS, Inc., and many other books. He wrote a positive review of the book, and he said something that I thought was rather pithy. He said, I think that Damien was able to survive the situation because he was already crazy to begin with.
Yeah.
And I don't mean clinically, crazy, but crazy in the sense that he's really just a genuine nonconformist and has never lived his life the way that other people live it. And so because he's already sort of outside the value grid of society, he was able to take that several steps further. And I think they were really sort of baffled and confused by him.
Well, you know, so many of the phenomena, the incidents that you report in this book, as with the Hunt for the Skinwalker book, are preposterous, seemingly on purpose, purposely preposterous, perhaps so no one else would take it seriously. It's theater, it's performance of some sort. And as you mentioned, Damien, there are some hilarious stories where he's being followed by 5, 6, 7, 8 of these jarheads, as you describe them, and he'll turn around and confront them and yell at them, and they have to pretend that he's not even there. It's funny, but it's also instructive of how you might be able to deal with these guys.
I think it is instructive. You know, it just occurred to me another parallel moment is you described the looking up into the night sky and seeing a blue sky, another sky in the sky.
Right.
And that's similar to when you looked out the window and saw the weird alien landscape. You mentioned in the book that you go through various proposals, various theories to describe, to explain what was happening on the ranch. And there's one chapter you devote to the possibility of this being a covert military experiment.
Right.
And then at the end, you kind of reject that, reasonably so, because you say, well, we know that the military wasn't experimenting with esoteric technology in 1865 because a paranormal phenomena has occurred on this location going back hundreds of years. But it occurred to me that maybe it's not an either-or proposition, that if you were going to experiment with esoteric technology, why not pick a spot that's already associated with supernatural phenomenon, where genuine supernatural phenomenon is already occurring, so your experiments are just going to sort of blur together.
Yeah, so anything that happens there is under the umbrella of, well, that's just the Skinwalker legend at work and not taken seriously. You know, we did have the remote viewer team take a look at it just sort of as a last resort, because we couldn't figure out what was going on there, the high strangeness, and they came back with these military images, an underground facility and people sitting in a control panel and the Navy stuff, and for the life of us, we couldn't figure out a naval connection because it's up there in northeastern Utah. But now I'm taking a new look at it, and Dr. Colm Kelleher, my co-author, had the same reaction. He's read your book, and he had the same reaction and wanted me to ask you about the Predator incident and everything, and I'll tell you, it's changed my perspective on a lot of stuff. I should also mention that it gets into the Bob Lazar story, and that came up in the interview that you had with the engineer who developed this technology.
Oh yeah, makes me think of something I wanted to ask you. I had heard this from someone else, so I figured I'd ask you while I have you on the phone. They told me that there was an incident where supposedly a unmarked helicopter landed on the ranch, and these military guys came out and actually accosted the NIDS researchers or roughed them up and threatened them and told them they should get off the ranch and supposedly destroyed their equipment or something like that.
That's not a story that I'm familiar with. I mean, I've heard some of that kind of stuff as internet chatter, but I know the NIDS guys pretty well, and they've never shared with me a story like that. I would certainly hear that. That's kind of a story that floats around online that is of questionable source.
Right. Okay. Well, I wanted to take this opportunity to get it from, you know, the horse's mouth. The Bob Lazar story. Richard mentions it because as we're talking to him, Richard suddenly thinks of the Bob Lazar story. And again, I didn't even know when we started talking to him that he would be familiar with that type of thing.
Right. I'll tell you what, the music is telling us we've got to take a break. It is interesting how over the course of that interview, he really opens up about a bunch of stuff, not only Bob Lazar, but also Colonel Philip Corso. We're going to get into that in a moment. We'll be opening up the phone lines for my guest, Robert Guffey, in a bit here on Coast to Coast AM.